This is the London Live Podcast. Listen live weekdays from 1 to 3 on 980 CFPL.
We've been paying very close attention to what is happening locally in this pandemic now that we have moved into red restrictions. And we wanted to find out how things were going at the BMO Center, simply because this is a center that has had all kinds of indoor soccer that has been played, another business that we can talk about that has all kinds of protocols in place, has followed and created restrictions, but is still a business. So how are things? Well, Tom Partalis joins us from the BMO Center. Tom, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome, Mike.
Tom, when we spoke after the second 22 restrictions were announced, there was some concern about scheduling and being able to operate the BMO Center. Some of that had to do with the fact that schedules had already come out, and now how do you rewrite everything? Now that we move into the red restrictions, what does that do for what is happening under your roof?
Well, right now, Mike, we started registrations late September, early October, and our leagues started in the middle of October, and of course we went until December the 13th, this past Sunday. So now we are closed. We have suspended all league games, all rentals, and scrimmages. So you can say that we're almost completely closed.
Well, that's not the way anybody wants things to be. Can you take us through the decision to instead of maybe look at ways to involve a few people where it's just decided that you close the doors and stop operations?
Well, we have to follow the guidance from in the protocols from the Ministry of Health, as long as and the Ontario Soccer. So we're only allowed right now under the red rules, we're allowed 10 players on a field. So that doesn't give us much room because most of our revenue comes from the team registrations. And we were closed from March the 13th. And now we're closing back again, December 13th. So if you're a superstitious guy, you'll say, oh, those are not very good dates. But the truth is that we did close in March of 13th. We stayed closed for about 6.5 months. The doors were locked. We didn't have anybody in the building. And at the end of September, we're starting to open up, getting registrations. And of course, every month we were going from green to yellow, and now we're red. And, the decision is that we cannot operate, because if you can't have games, and of course there were no contact games, but still no scrimmages, a lot of the young players are not going to be coming out. So all the leagues now are suspended until further notice. And hopefully that after a month, after the 28 days, when the City of London may be going back to the orange or yellow, and then we can resume play.
We're talking with Tom Partalis from the BMO Center, finding out how things are going there. And Tom has let us know that watch out for the date with a 13 in it. You're right, if you're superstitious, but that's been the closure date for two different periods. What does it mean to the overall operation of the BMO Center to have closures like this? Obviously, you're not having money come in, but this is a big venue. This is a spot that that certainly has some overhead costs. What is the impact of closing the doors for periods of time?
Well, it has a huge impact on our financial and our revenues, because if you don't get any money coming in, it's really hard to plan ahead and do things. It's really hard. It has right now been closed for over 6 months, and then we're closed now indefinitely. We don't know if it's going to be 4 weeks, if it's going to be 5 weeks. So we have to do a lot of creative financing because that's the only thing we could do right now. We did get some help from the government, like everybody else did. And the only thing I can say, Mike, is that we're not the only ones in the London area. Every business is going through the same problems as we are. And we just hope that we can make it this year and we'll keep the place open.
Tom, is there a risk that you wouldn't be able to? Are you looking into the future in that way, or is it still a day-by-day, week-by-week, month-by-month, let's see what happens?
Well, it is that. We're going right now month by month. We do have bills to pay, and I know that we negotiated with the bank as far as the principal and interest on the mortgage. And the next thing is the property taxes. As you know, Mike, or some people don't know, that we pay over $200,000 property tax this year. At the BMO, and that is, you know, a substantial amount. And I know other places don't pay as much, so they're not going to be as hard hit as we are. You know, the JLC or the Budweiser Garden, they don't pay any property taxes, and I know a lot of people don't know that, but we are paying a lot of taxes here, and hopefully we can talk to the city if the need comes.
And that's something that hasn't happened just yet, but that's something that you would entertain in talking with the city?
Correct. Yeah, we will do that. But right now, we're still holding our own, and we're paying our bills, and, you know, we're surviving. And I just hope that we're not going to be closed for more than the 4 weeks in the red zone, and I hope we're not going into the gray, which means a complete lockdown. So we're just being optimistic and hopeful that things will get better, and hope by the end of January we can resume our activities here at the BMO.
Well, Tom, you always have an optimistic outlook. Don't lose that, and let's see where we do sit at the end of the 28-day period that we're in right now. We really appreciate the update and the information, Tom. All the best through the holidays.
Thank you, Mike. All the best to you.
Please keep safe.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye. That is Tom Partalis from the BMO Center. So we talk about overhead, and you think about what it would cost to operate a center like the BMO Center, which is a big building. So you add in all your amenities and those sorts of things, and you add in what it would cost simply to pay the hydro bill. And then a property tax bill of $200,000 a year, that means you have to find a way to generate revenue. And being off from March to September and now off 28 days at least right now puts that into a tough spot. So we'll see how things go. We'll continue to follow that story at the BMO Center. But as Tom pointed out, it's no different than any other businesses. It's no different than anybody who's trying to pay their own rent in their home. And that's why we'll get to that a little later on in the show, where the idea that evictions would be a topic at the beginning of this, hey, it was, no, let's protect. But some of those protections have gone away. And when protections go away, you're exposed, you become vulnerable, and we do have certain situations for individuals that aren't as rosy as they used to be, and it's still, okay, well, how long? And we don't have an answer. We get the glimmers of news today that in PEI they have now vaccinated someone, and in Newfoundland, Labrador, they have vaccinated someone, and these stories will kind of die down a little bit, and then instead of being, hey, the vaccine has arrived, look at this, every province has this person who has been vaccinated, and that's fantastic, and a lot of times they are healthcare workers, and you can either see it on their face, or if they talk about it, you certainly hear it from them, the absolute exhaustion that they feel, and it's a feeling that they can't necessarily put into words, the idea that they have been vaccinated, that they have been staying away from family members if their family members have been grown because they've been in the healthcare sector. These are all beautiful stories. Then the story will turn to, okay, who's next? And how many vaccines are here? And how many doses of those vaccines are here? And when is my turn? And that's going to be something that changes in a hurry. The idea of, hey, here's the plane and everything's arriving. And it is really only that, isn't it? It's really only that and the rollout of this vaccine that will allow businesses to say, okay, I can now see that finish line. But is it 4 months away? Is it 6 months away? Is it 9 months away? Nobody can really speak to that yet. And then the other question that's coming up, and you can go to globalnews.ca right now and see an example of this. The top trending story right now at globalnews.ca is this one. How long will the COVID-19 vaccine protect you? And here's what we know so far. Every once in a while, we get an opportunity to boil it down. As humans, what do we need? Need water, number one. Need some food. We need some shelter. Beyond that, it's kind of up to us. How much more do you want? How minimalist are you? But being a minimalist has nothing to do with those first three things. You need those things. And we just talked about an affordable housing project that is going to be built and should be ready in about a year from now. And that's good. It will have 61 units, and rents will be 50% to 80% of what is the going rate in London, which right now is roughly an average of $1,000 a month, which is still a lot of money, but certainly that is helpful. Now, when we look at this pandemic and the wake that it may leave behind for people who are renting homes, it's kind of unknown right now how big that wake is going to rise, but we're starting to get a picture of it, and that picture isn't great. Joining us right now is someone who can help us to understand how things are looking in the housing world for people who rent. Please welcome to London Live, Toronto Centre, NDP, MPP, and housing critic Suze Morrison. Ms. Morrison, thank you so much for taking some time for us.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's kind of lay things out here, because there was a call for a long, long time to put a moratorium on evictions for businesses, and certainly there have been some things put in place, but at the same time, we don't want to see anybody evicted from their homes, especially in December in Ontario, where you can't find a warm spot. How big an issue is this?
It's about to be massive, honestly. We know we had a temporary residential eviction moratorium in Ontario, and unfortunately that was lifted in August because it was tied to the original state of emergency. But we know that throughout the year, folks have lost their jobs, they've lost their income through no fault of their own, and people have struggled to pay the rent in full every month. And people are making their best efforts. Some people might only be behind, a couple hundred dollars a month, and they're trying, in good faith to pay as much rent as they can every month, but they're still slipping behind. With shutdowns in more and more cities, people are losing their jobs for the second time this year. And what we're seeing now is, more than 7,000 eviction hearings scheduled between now and January as the Landlord and Tenant Board proceeds with what they're calling an eviction blitz going into the winter months. In a pandemic, when the premier promised us in his own words back in March that no one was going to lose their home as a result of COVID-19, and it's just not true.
So 7,000. To us, that sounds like a big number. If we weren't in a pandemic right now, would that number be an awful lot smaller?
I absolutely think it would be. What we're seeing from the board is a politicized effort to fast track as many hearings as possible. They're doing more hearings every day than they ever have before. And part of the reason behind that was the backlog of cases that was allowed to balloon at the board, which is hurting landlords and tenants. It's not helpful to anyone to have a backlog of cases when people are waiting for their, you know, their day at the tribunal. But that backlog exists for a couple of reasons. You know, it partially exists because of the temporary shutdown and evictions that we had for part of the year. But the backlog existed in January because the Conservative government wasn't appointing adjudicators to the board when their terms were up. So they allowed this backlog to fester going before the pandemic started. And then obviously we had the few months of shutdown that added to the backlog. And instead of focusing their energies on doing everything humanly possible right now to keep as many folks as housed, so that we can, you know, get through the last leg of this pandemic together, as we, you know, are looking forward to the vaccine, you know, this government is putting political pressure on the board to fast track all of these evictions, schedule as many as possible as fast as possible, to get out from under an administrative backlog, for entirely political reasons, because of a forthcoming ombuds report that I think is going to be quite damning as to why that backlog existed in the first place.
So the idea is clear that, and then the ombudsman will be kinder.
I think that's their hope right now. But, you know, it's an entirely backwards approach. Is it our first priority that there's an administrative backlog on evictions cases in a pandemic? No, because we shouldn't be processing evictions at all. You know, and beyond that, not only are we seeing thousands of families falling potentially into homelessness in the next few months as a result of COVID-19, but the way that the evictions are happening as a result of this renewed effort to fast track these cases, and as a result of moving the hearings online, you know, these eviction hearings are happening in as little as 60 seconds while people are struggling to get connected to the technology. And there are serious concerns from legal advocates that these online hearings are actually violating human rights and violating the basic principles of access to justice in our legal system.
Okay, so let's try and understand how those are taking place. We're talking with Toronto yeah. Centre NDP MPP and housing critic Suze Morrison about tenant evictions. This is something where there was help under the state of emergency, but when that state of emergency was lifted, that assistance went away, and now we've got a backlog, we've got a lot of schedules. So how are these things taking place then? Because we can't have people filing in and out of courtrooms.
Yeah, so the online hearings are happening on Microsoft Teams. But the very first barrier is the assumption that was made somewhere along the line that everyone in Ontario has access to a phone or to a computer or to stable enough internet connections, that they have enough minutes on their pay-as-you-go phones to actually access these hearings reliably and consistently. And that premise is simply not true. And it's created an entire equity issue. In terms of the folks that are the most impoverished and the most vulnerable, who don't have internet, who don't have cell phones, who can't even get connected to their own eviction hearings to make an attempt at, you know, making a repayment plan to get caught up. They're just being, having their evictions rubber stamped in as little as 60 seconds. The folks that do get connected to these hearings are facing huge barriers. We've seen issues with people being dropped in and out of the Zooms, sound issues, connectivity issues, people with disabilities that are being denied in-person hearings to accommodate those disabilities, people with language barriers that aren't getting access to translators. And the board has reallocated all of their resources to scheduling as many eviction hearings as fast as humanly possible. And so there's no one staffing the phones or checking the fax machines. So stays of eviction are getting lost and people are being evicted despite the fact that their evictions have been called off. You know, people are trying to get access to information about their cases and no one's picking up the phones. It is an absolute nightmare at the LTB right now.
I don't even know where you would begin to address half of those things that you are mentioning.
Yeah, which is why we're calling for an immediate moratorium on evictions in Ontario. I tabled a motion last week before the legislature rose for the holidays, calling for a renewed ban on evictions until we're through the COVID crisis. That motion passed unanimously. the will of the legislature backs the call for an eviction moratorium, but the premier is refusing to act. He's refusing to do anything about it. You know, we know that there's several mechanisms that he can use to enact a moratorium on evictions, and he just lacks the political will to do it.
We're talking right now with Suze Morrison. And Suze is a Toronto Centre NDP MPP and also housing critic as we look at eviction. So, I mean, if we've got 7,000 of these hearings, they're being processed lickety-split. People are not getting information. Is the ultimate at the end of this, if you can't present significant evidence or if you really don't even have access to your hearing, would each one of these possibly end in an actual eviction, people actually being tossed out into the street?
Absolutely they are. You know, we heard of a case down in St. Catharines of a residential school survivor who had applied for a stay of eviction, and their landlord or their legal representative tried to fax it into the board dozens and dozens and dozens of times. The board's not even checking their fax machine, and the sheriff showed up and evicted a residential school survivor, despite every legal attempt to stop that process from actually happening. And that residential school survivor was evicted into homelessness. You know, we've heard of cases, a few cases up in the north, where the legal aid lawyers are so frustrated with the lack of due process at the board and the inability to get hearings on stays of eviction, for example. They've gone to superior courts. Like, they're having to go back into the court system, which is not where these cases are supposed to be handled, to try and get access to justice for their clients. It's an absolute mess out there. And the worst part is that people are only behind on their rent because they were never given the financial support that they needed to weather the COVID crisis and shelter in place. People lost their jobs because of shutdowns. Many are losing their jobs for a second time this year. And this government never delivered on things like rent subsidies to help folks stay housed, and instead are sitting on $12 billion of unspent money that could be helping people through this pandemic and hoarding it instead of preventing evictions into homelessness.
When you look at where your motion could go next, is it stalled at the feet of the premier? Do we look there?
Absolutely it is. It is absolutely at the feet of the premier and nowhere else. The motion passed unanimously through the legislature, and he needs to act to implement it.
Wow. Well, Suze, we really appreciate you giving details on this. Is this something you would say is widespread? Is it in the bigger centers? Where would you pinpoint it?
It's all over the province. I mean, you know, I know that we're feeling it really acutely here in downtown Toronto because, you know, our rents are just so unbearably high. I mean, the average price of a one-bedroom apartment in my community is $2,100 a month. So the CERB check didn't pay the rent if you live in downtown Toronto. But that's not to say that, you know, rents aren't still unbearably high compared to the cost of living in almost every municipality in the province, London included. And we know that these evictions are happening in every corner of the province. It's not a Toronto problem. It's a London problem. It's a Hamilton problem. It's a Sudbury problem. It's a Timmins problem. It's happening everywhere.
Ms. Morrison, thank you so much for your voice in this, because the last thing we want to see is more and more people either going into a system that already is having issues finding enough places for people to stay, or worse, having to go out onto the streets in the cold months of winter. Thank you for the time. Thank you for your voice in this, and we'll certainly watch this story closely.
Thanks so much for having me.
That is Suze Morrison, Toronto Centre NDP MPP and housing critic. So questions do arise, and whether it's $12 billion, whether it's being spent in some way, there is an amount of money that the province has not used for this pandemic. And you can understand saying, we don't know when this thing is over, so we've got to make sure that we've got money on hand. But when do you start spending? When do you start making use of money? And keeping people in homes, that should be a priority as far as I'm concerned. Not sure. You know, when you have a backlog and the idea is to clear the backlog so it doesn't look bad, if that is the impetus for doing this, that's wrong. That's wrong. That's where you say, okay, I'm going to take a lump from an ombudsman report. You just take that lump. That's what you take. You don't try and clear backlogs. So if that is the case, if that is what's happening, and in the eyes of housing critic Suze Morrison, that is what's happening, then this does not look good, and at the same time, it is dangerous. It's very dangerous for anybody who right now is trying to make ends meet just to get through the holidays, let alone having to keep a roof over their heads. In the meantime, we have another story to tell. And this is one that is fascinating. At the same time, it is real. And when you get something that has a great fascination to it, but something that has a very real core, it's something that we all need to hear. There is a book that has been written, a memoir, and it is called Booze and the Badge. And it's been written by Barry Rule, and it is a cop's battle with the bottle. And we are very lucky to have with us right now Barry Rule himself. Barry, thanks so much for taking some time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
Let's look back over this, because this is a memoir. This deals with your own life, and it deals with some real struggles that you have had in your life. What brought you to want to share these so publicly?
Essentially, for all the time that I was abusing alcohol, and that this is essentially like a positive thing to do. It's a way of righting a wrong from my years of substance abuse. And what I'm trying to do with the book is give it to folks, especially the law enforcement community, officers that are having issues with substance abuse. They can look at it and say, you know what, he got through it. Took quite a while, but he did get through it. And maybe some of the stuff in this book will help me.
When we look at policing, we look at anything that first responders are taxed with, we're starting to talk more and more about needing to have assistance in many ways for some of the individuals who they will go and see, or on calls that they will get on a day-to-day basis. But you're somebody who is an example of, hey, needing maybe a little bit of support the other way. How do you feel that your life went in the direction that it did? What can you point to, Barry?
Well, with me, it started, I'm from St. Thomas originally, actually Lyndhurst. And I started drinking at a very young age, probably around 14, at home. And after my first beer, I was chasing the high, and it never stopped. From that point on, up until 7 years ago, it was a roller coaster ride. I just, it wasn't like I had issues. I just enjoyed the high, getting high. And I think like a lot of people, once I had a couple of hoists, I could go to a party and have lots of fun. If I was sober, it was like I was, you know, sitting back doing nothing and staying away from people.
When we look at policing, this is not a 9-to-5 job. It can be very difficult to say, all right, I'm going to find a way to chase that high. How did those two parts of your life intertwine, your work and chasing that high?
Well, for one thing, I always went into work, no matter how hungover I was. I never drank on the job. But on the days off, lots of times when I was alone, I'd drink, and it kept going. I at one point, Mike, I stopped drinking for nine years. I went to the International Police Olympics in Austin, Texas, and after a 10,000 meter on the track, 98-degree weather, an Aussie that beat me came up and handed me a beer, and I didn't even think I drank it. And guess what? I kept drinking that night, and I asked one of the RCMP buddies to get a case of beer, and I gave him $5. And he said, "When the hell did you? When did you buy your last beer?" You know.
So. And did it continue after that as well?
No. That's an interesting question. That I really felt bad. I woke up the next day hungover, and I had to run a half a marathon, and it was terrible. I should have methyled in it, but I was just really hungover. I went for a long walk that day. Thought a lot about it. I felt really bad about it. And the next day I went into a 5,000 meter and I won it. I won the gold. And flying home on the plane, I vowed I'd never do it again. And guess what? There was a relapse.
We're talking with Barry Rule, who has written a memoir, Booze and the Badge, A Cop's Battle with the Bottle. When you look at some of the stresses of the job, and being a first responder can certainly bring an awful lot of those, did this become a coping mechanism at any time, or was it something different than that?
Well, it was a coping mechanism in some ways for me. I recall one case where I had to make a notification, and it was going up to I still recall it, outside of Collingwood. Guy was killed, and I had to go up to notify his wife. They were standing at the door. There was about a five-year-old child with his wife. And I walked up, and I had to give her the news. It was tough. It was my first time doing it. And back in the good old days, they never talked about notifications, so I just did the best I could. And when I finished telling her, the little guy looked up at her and said, "Don't cry, Dad. Don't cry, Mommy. I'll get you a new daddy." And I lost it. Like, I went home, and my best companion that night was a bottle of booze. You know?
Wow.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just a Tuesday. That's something that officers will deal with at any time in any place.
That's right. Exactly right. And there is a lot of stress on the job. A lot of officers, you know, they do use the booze to medicate. The issue with it is, of course, you have your booze, you forget about one of your horrendous cases you're on or investigations, but it doesn't last because the next day it comes back to bite you because you're hungover and it doesn't work. I mean, get out and run or work out or do something, but the booze just don't work.
We're talking with Barry Rule. He has put together a memoir, Booze and the Badge, A Cop's Battle with the Bottle. It also outlines another battle that you have had in life, a battle with prostate cancer.
Yeah, that was a real whammy. I quit drinking, and I went to my doctor, and yeah, they found a small growth, and long story short, I had the radical prostatectomy when I was only 50 years old. The interesting thing about it, Mike, my wife went to my doctor, and she says, you know, Barry's seems to be peeing an awful lot, and she's concerned. So I went in, and yeah, they did one of those, I don't know, they checked anyway, and I had a small tumor, and I had to have it out, and had I not had it out, it was on the capsule, I would have been in big trouble within 5 years.
Wow. And you look back on the battle that you have had with alcoholism, the battle that you had with cancer. When you look at yourself today, what do those battles look like?
Well, it was a roller coaster. And, you know, you can't look back on this stuff and say, woe is me, or why the hell did I do that, and whatever. I've had 7 years of sobriety now. We're up in Southampton, my wife and myself, and of course we're like everybody else. We're inside, but we enjoy life. You know, I feel wonderful without it, and hopefully I've got to just remember every day, Mike, that you know, I'm just one drink away from relapse. I can't drink, period, or I'll be back. I mean, I laid in the laneway behind our place for 3 hours. I couldn't get up. And that was horrendous. That was one of my last times when I finally quit.
And was that after you had taken a drink, or was that preventing yourself from taking a drink?
No, that was, you know, I vowed I was going to quit drinking, and it was only about seven years ago, eight, when it happened. And we've been out drinking, and, you know, I always go out, and I'd have a couple of hoists before I left for a party. I love vodka on the ice. And I get to the party, and I drank like a fool, and going home, I was walking my bike. I couldn't ride it, and I ended up with the bike on top of me, and I couldn't get up. I laid there for 3 hours, and it just scared the living out of me, and, you know, from that point on, I managed to quit, and, you know, quite frankly, my dear wife, Pat, said to me, you know, either quit or I'm out of here, and God bless her for that, because she didn't need that, and she didn't need it over the years, and there's nothing I can do about it. I just made some foolish, you know, I did some foolish things. But, you know, I'm on track. I look forward. And I'm hoping with this book I can help officers in that and their families. Because It's not just the officer or the person abusing substance abuse. The families suffer immensely, even the kids. A lot of kids grow up and they become adult children of alcoholics, and that's a whole different malady.
Absolutely. Barry, it is said sometimes that if you are struggling with addiction, there is a time when you have to hit bottom. Would that time laying on the driveway, would that have been your bottom?
No, we have to go back before, just after we got married. So that's about 46 years ago. And we went to visit a cousin who couldn't get to our wedding. And I ended up in the Meaford General Hospital. And the doctor came in the next day and said, you almost killed yourself. Your alcohol level was, I think it was over 5. And like a friend of mine said to me, he said, you know, how you ever survived, we'll never know, because I almost died that day, and that was basically the end of it, except, ironically, I quit drinking. I kept drinking, but I was stiffing. I didn't drink a lot. And I went to the Hook and Ladder Club when it was in Toronto with my family. They were having a birthday party. And, you know, I had a martini. I love martinis, and I had one, and it seemed to affect me, and I thought, you know what, I think I wrecked my liver. So I decided to quit, and that was another time that I announced that night, you know, I'm going to quit, and I did, and that was for a couple years as well. And then I was back on it. You know, it was just up and down, Mike. It's an awful disease.
Like you say, it's been a roller coaster. Barry Rule joining us. Barry has written a memoir, Booze and the Badge, A Cop's Battle with the Bottle. But at the same time, being able to tell these stories, being able to say, hey, you don't necessarily quit cold turkey. Things can happen. This can kind of kick back in. How key a part of the story of your life do you think that might be for somebody else?
I'm not sure that when I look at it, Mike, everybody's different in terms of relapse or in terms of drinking. And, you know, if you think you have a problem, check it out to make sure, because you very well could, and you very well may need help. So that's the best I can say about it.
Have you had reaction to the book at all yet, or is that still to come?
No. What is really interesting, it's only been out for about a week and a half on, and it's been on my Facebook and with Friesen Press and the Amazon and that, and it sold about 25 copies already. And what is interesting, when I was talking about the book with people, just about every person I've talked to, they say, well, you know what, I have someone, or I have a friend, or I have a cousin who's having a problem with booze. And I got to tell you, in society, as you probably know, Mike, you probably know a few folks that have had problems with it. There's a lot of people in trouble, and this COVID isn't going to help with people sitting inside worrying and stressed out. And, it, you know, this stuff costs bucks. I don't know what it costs now because I don't drink anymore, but I'm sure it's up there.
Oh, absolutely. And you raised the issue. I mean, we see stats in different studies about binge drinking and the increase in binge drinking. So here's an opportunity for somebody to sit down, read what you have gone through, and gain something from it. Barry, thanks so much for the courage to put this down on paper and share the story publicly. You mentioned your Facebook page. That's a good way to get it. Anywhere else to find the book?
Yeah, it's on Amazon. And it's also a Friesen Press. They have it, and it's e-books. Every Hulu, Amazon, CA, and there's a few others that have it. Most of the e-book platforms have it.
All right. Well, Friesen Press, you can find them at books.friesenpress.com. Again, Barry, thanks so much for putting these words down on paper for anyone else to read. And thanks so much for the time this afternoon. Please keep safe and enjoy the holidays.
Yeah, be well, Mike.
That's Barry Rule. And if you're looking for the spelling of Barry's last name, it's R-U-H-L. So Barry Rule, R-U-H-L. Booze and the Badge, A Cop's Battle with the Bottle. And the roller coaster ride that Barry had gone on that ultimately has left him in a better spot. It can happen.
You've been listening to the London Live Podcast. Catch the show live on weekdays from 1 to 3.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.